Hour number three, Chase and Big Joe, 102.5 The Game on this Monday at Circus Sports here in Kentucky at the Mint at Kentucky Downs. And it's now time to talk to John McClain down in Houston, who joins us every Monday at 2. John, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm just looking at the internet, and I'm thinking about Dexter Lawrence next to Jeffrey Simmons, Dexter Lawrence next to Sheldon Rankin's here. He makes a lot of money. He wants a lot of money. But who has the most salary cap room in the NFL? Who's the other starting tackle next to Simmons right now?
Franklin Myers, who they just signed from Denver.
Yeah, and can he play outside as well?
Yes.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, Lawrence is a pretty good player. Giants, I don't know why they got money, why they don't pay him, because that's all they got on defense right now is their defensive line. But a lot of talk they want a first and second round pick for him. I don't know if people would do that, but this defensive class with defensive lineman class is nothing special. Peter Woods from Clemson's only one that they say can rush the passer. All their guys who stop the run, but I think nobody wants to pay him a monster salary. But, like, you know, if you got the money, you got to spend it somewhere, right?
You do. I know it's in division, but with Jerry having two first-round picks, is that, you think that'd be up his alley?
I don't think so. I think he needs defensive backs. I think their line's pretty good. Maybe. But I don't think that's what they're looking for, is an interior player like him. Although Lawrence, you know, he's not great, but he's really good at times. He can be great. I wouldn't give up a 1 and a 2 for him, 28 years old, wanting a mountain of money.
One thing, John, that we have been talking about, obviously with you and amongst ourselves, is Jeremiah Love and the Titans. But what we're worried about now is, could the Jets or the Cardinals screw that up? And could Dallas play a factor in that, having those two first-round picks? Could Jerry try and make a deal to move up to 2 and take, you know, whoever he wants? That's something that we've kind of thought about today. What do you see with that in that scenario?
I don't see any team ahead of the Titans taking Jeremiah Love. Arizona has already signed one free agent and re-signed James Conner. The Jets have Breece Hall. They plan to re-sign him, and maybe there's another team. But the Cowboys' offense was not the issue. Javonte Williams had over 1,000 yards. He's already been signed to an extension that is a really good extension for the Cowboys. So the Cowboys need defense. Now, I'm still amazed, and maybe Mike Bergonzi will cross up everybody and take a pass rusher instead of Jeremiah Love, when a pass rusher cannot dominate nearly as much as Love doesn't touch the ball. Al Davis one time said he wanted guys who could put the ball in the end zone. That was his priority, get guys who could put the ball in the end zone and then worry about everybody else. Well, Jeremiah Love can put the ball in the end zone, and if he's healthy, he should be able to play 7-8 years, maybe longer. I still have a hard time figuring out why people have devalued running back, although it's coming back. People say, well, Bijan Robinson may be the best in the NFL. He's a great receiver and a runner. And look where the Falcons have been. Well, that's not his fault. That's their fault. So, as I told you guys before, I think everybody in the AFC South would be happy if they passed up on Love. And I would hate to see him end up with Kansas City. I don't think they're going to do it. I wouldn't want to see him with New Orleans. They're looking for, I guess they think, they're looking for a new guy to replace Kamara. And I don't see teams trading up to get a running back. But, boy, if the Titans could get him, you guys would eat it up, because you'd see a guy who is hell on wheels.
Oh, we can't wait. John McClain's on. That's with the Chase and Big Joe show. John, you know, beyond the fourth pick and people calling and talking about who they're going to pick at 4, the next question is almost every day, what about Will Levis? All right, so they signed Hendon Hooker last week. They got a backup in Mitch Trubisky already. How much you know, cachet does Borgonzi have with Will Levis? Because some team is going to need a nice arm, or is this Will Levis expected to be cut? Some team pick him up?
Yeah, I think he'll be cut. The one I'm interested in is Liam Cohen, because he was his coach when he had his best year at Kentucky. And so Cohen would know him. And both Cohen has really advanced, and to see if he'd be interested in bringing him over there as a backup to a quarterback who's been remarkably durable. And once they signed Trubisky, they told you what they thought about Will Levis. And anytime you got a new coach, he's not going to stand pat at certain positions, especially the most important one on the team. And I remember when Hendon Hooker came out, where did he end up going in the third round to Detroit?
Yes.
And he was coming off the injury. I remember talking to two or three people that I respected who had coached quarterbacks or call plays as offensive coordinators who liked him. Not that year, but liked his traits and were excited to see where he would be like in 3 years if he ever got a chance to play. Well, he should be very happy that he gets to come back to Tennessee. And I always remembered that. And so we'll see. The third quarterback's not supposed to play, of course. I really like the Trubisky play. I'm surprised, move, that more teams don't spend more money on quality veteran backup quarterbacks.
Oh, I'm with you. And, you know, that's the Kirk Cousins deal going to the Raiders is exactly what you're talking about.
Great move. Great move. Case Keenum was here as a backup in 23, C.J. Stroud's rookie year. Well, they made a lot of changes the second year. Well, one of them is they didn't try to re-sign Keenum. He went to the Bears. Look what happened to Caleb Williams after he got there. Case is a guy that we've known since he was at the University of Houston before he's been on like 15 NFL teams. If he wants to be a coach, he'll be a coach. If he wants to be an NFL coach or a college coach, University of Houston has a standing offer. He lives here in off season. He has season tickets to their football, basketball, all their sports. He's a diehard Cougar. But I'll guarantee you that there are so many coaches out there who would offer him a job coaching quarterbacks. And the relationship he had with Stroud, and I'm assuming with Williams, that he's with them every day. He's with them in the locker room, sitting in front of their lockers, talking to them. Quarterback coach doesn't get to do that. And so that's why I think Texans were foolish to let him get away. And when people talk about what's happened to Stroud the last 2 years, yes, a lot of it, they don't have an offensive line, couldn't run the ball this year. But I think you cannot overlook Case Keenum. And the teams that will pay a little extra money and cut back somewhere else to get a quality backup quarterback who can help on the field and off the field, some are missing the boat.
Eight NFL teams, including three stints with the Texans for Case Keenum. Just looked it up.
I thought it was going to be more than that. One of the greatest guys I've ever known, and who was just great in a locker room. And I think, you know, the Bears just signed him to another deal. He can stick around for a long time, making a few million a year, and there's worse things you can do.
Oh, absolutely. John, a question on draft night. How involved should a head coach be on draft night? Meaning, how much input should a Robert Saleh have on draft night? Or any coach around the league, but, you know, we talk about the Titans here. You know, we know what he wants. He's not really drafted defensive guys early in his career as a head coach. This all changes now, but how much input should a head coach have on draft night?
Well, he didn't have too much because Woody Johnson makes those moves up there. He has to sign off on the big ones. But if you're Kyle Shanahan, Andy Reid, if you're one of those guys, you have final say. The GM oversees the scouting, and then they come to you and you decide, okay, you know, I want Chase or I want Joe. And that's who you get because he has final say. But in Saleh's case, I'll guarantee you Borgonzi's going to work closely with him. This is something I learned a long time ago from a former Oilers general manager, Mike Olivak. He said, and we were talking specifically about Jack Pardee, who was the Oilers head coach. He said, if there's a guy I really like, but Jack doesn't, he said, I'd be foolish to draft him because Jack might not play him just because he didn't like him coming in. He said, and if there's a guy that Jack likes and I don't, he said, Jack's going to play him come hell or high water just to prove he was right. So you have to have a meeting in the middle. We give Nick Caserio all kinds of grief for the offensive line he has failed to put together, despite using first-round, second-round picks, making trades, signing free agents. But the coaches sign off on it. The coaches have control of the game day roster, so they don't have to play anybody they don't want to play. So I guarantee you, Robert Saleh is heavily involved in the scouting, the evaluation, and he'll be heavily involved when they're making those picks. But, you know, it's Mike Bergonzi's responsibility because that's what it says in his contract.
We'll have more with John McClain coming up next here on Chasing Big Joe on this Monday, 102.5 The Game. Chasing Big Joe, 102.5 The Game here on this Monday, continuing with John McClain, who's down in Houston. John, we were talking earlier, Bill Barnwell does a kind of a trade mock draft every year of potential trade scenarios with different teams. And one that kind of had us intrigued was the Titans moving back with Kansas City, moving to 9. They'd get an extra second-round pick, and Kansas City would move up to 4. I've basically said only if Love is not there, and then they kind of look towards the end of the top 10. What would you think about something like that?
Well, I don't see Kansas City trading up for Love after they got Walker. So that'd be an edge rusher you'd think they would want because they need to add to their defense. And so dropping back, you're not going to get Love. You got to decide, well, what we got is good enough. If you had a really good veteran quarterback who'd been in the league a few years instead of a young guy's talent who's still learning, I would think that would be better than if you're where you are now and you could use another weapon as a rusher and a receiver like Love. So I would not be in favor of that unless Arizona had traded with, like, New Orleans so the Saints could get Love.
And then another one that I thought was interesting was making a move with Buffalo to move back into the first round, take the 26th overall pick. The Titans would give up the 35th overall pick and the 66th overall pick, but they'd get 26, 168, and wide receiver Keon Coleman. And there's a lot of discussion with Coleman. Is he a good culture fit? You know, is he lazy? All those things. But I just look at, you know, could it be a change of scenery with a coach that, you know, is going to preach discipline and be the yet another weapon for Cam Ward?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
A guy who had baggage coming out, he's got baggage up there. Maybe he'll grow up. Maybe, but what we've seen from him at this point as a second-round pick for a Super Bowl team playing with Josh Allen, and I'll guarantee you McDermott did everything he could. So did Joe Brady. Get that kid to play the way he's capable, and they couldn't do it. I wouldn't touch him.
John, we last week, Jackson Smith, Jigba, had that big deal with the Seahawks. You know, wide receivers in this draft are getting talked about. At what point are we going to – I mean, somebody's got to cover these guys, right? And we've talked about this before about paying defensive backs on that same level. Do you think we'll get to that same level in a couple of years, or is it always going to be the wide receivers making so much money and the DBs always being secondary? Because somebody's got to cover these wide receivers.
I wouldn't give a wide receiver $42 million a year, I can tell you that. And because at what point does it stop? Then your other players want it. Seattle's cruising for a financial bruising because of that deal. I wonder, would he have said no if it was only $40 million a year? Always amazed at guys like, I remember when A-Rod signed for $53 million?
Yeah.
Which was by far the most, and I'm thinking, what if they'd say, we're not giving you the extra three, we're only giving you 250, which is still 100 million more than anybody else has ever made? They're going to go, no, I'm not going to take that. Anyway, I think the corners, right now, the way it is, You got your quarterback, then you want a receiver. You got to have who protects the quarterback, rushes the quarterback, and who covers them. Everybody else, you can safeties, fullbacks, guards, centers, even running backs. Although, when you run the ball consistently, like Seattle did, people forget how well the Seahawks ran the ball with Clint Kubiak. He is a stickler for running the ball to set up the play-action bootlegs that are so important to that offense that Mike Shanahan started and Gary Kubiak kept up. So you have got to be able to run the ball, and that's why I tell people in weekly show I do in Las Vegas, this team will run the ball so much better than last year. Ashton Jenny had a great game against the Texans here, and they almost pulled off upset. I said, that's what you're going to see from him under Clint Kubiak, taking pressure off of Fernando Mendoza, you know, when he gets in the game. So I'm still for a guy that could help you control the ball on a running game, defense on the field. Keep the defense on the bench.
Yeah, I like that too. John, earlier we were talking about Sterling Sharp, about, you know, he played 88 to 94 and it was not part of the Packers winning the Super Bowl in 96. I started thinking, all those Oilers teams you covered, and I know the two AFC championship games with the Steelers, but was there one team in particular when the Oilers were there that you thought should have won the Super Bowl?
Well, I never thought that about the Love You Blue Oilers because they played in the same division with the Steelers and the Steel Curtain, who won four in 6 years with a roster loaded with the Hall of Famers. The Oilers had four, Earl Campbell, Robert Brazil, Curly Culp, and Elvin Bethea. But the 93 Oilers, in which Buddy Ryan was the defensive coordinator, and they had the best defense in the league, they knocked out 11 starting quarterbacks.
Phew.
That season. They had the run and shoot. They were loaded. They had a 1,000-yard rusher and Gary Doo-Doo Brown, and they had everything you want. And they lost here to Kansas City in the last miracle of Joe Montana's career, a pass that beat them, and they overcame a 10-point deficit. That, to me, was the best team I've ever seen that didn't get to a Super Bowl.
And that's what was Pardee let go the next year?
Yeah, he was fired after an 0-10 start, and Jeff Fisher was promoted, and the rest was history.
Well, was that a hangover, John, heading into the 94 season after being so good in 93?
No. Free agency started. Bud Adams came to training camp for his annual State of the Union with the players and the media, and he started talking about this newfangled salary cap. Floyd Reese was in his first year as GM, and how there had so many Pro Bowl players making so much money, he wasn't going to be able to keep them. And players reached into their wallets and started throwing $1 bills at him to try to bail him out.
Gosh.
And they did a terrible job. Traded Warren Moon for like a fourth-round pick, lost half their defensive line. People came in there and picked all that talent apart. And, of course, they bounced back with Floyd and Jeff running the show. But that was pretty unbelievable. And so they went from 12-4 to 2-14 right when they were asking for a better lease from the Astrodome, on the Astrodome from the county. You talk about bad timing. It was the worst one-season plunge in NFL history.
John McClain is with us. Real quick, I know you're a big baseball guy. What have you thought about the ABS challenge and that kind of technology that they've used so far?
I think we got some morons, because players calling for a challenge in the second inning and losing, and you got one left. There's no one strike if you're up at the plate by yourself that's going to make a difference. Managers somehow ought to have somebody looking at a big screen next to them, and they see a pitch, challenge. Don't let the players do it. Let them challenge it. But I see that all the time. And I see a lot of broadcasters don't know the rules. Don't know if you're in the 10th inning and you use it, and you go to 11th inning, you have another one. If you don't use them, you still get one in every inning. They're trying to figure it out. But I've seen some ridiculous challenges on the part of the Astros early in a game, and I'm thinking, why don't you tell those guys, don't be challenging early in the game?
I don't want to see, you know, coaches necessarily challenging every play in the NFL, but I kind of look at, you know, the technology that's available when, you know, talking about ABS and even some of the ways they use it in the NFL now with the first down markers and stuff like that. Do you think that the league is utilizing everything to their full advantage, or do we need to see more to make sure that they're getting the play right while also maintaining pace of play?
I'm wondering why they say if they have to use these backup officials, which I don't believe they will help them in New York. And I'm thinking, why the hell don't you help the regular officials?
Yeah.
We watch it on TV, see all kinds of mistakes. What if you could challenge anything, but the coaches didn't have more challenges? That wouldn't slow down the game. That's what Bill Belichick always wanted. They never considered it. And to me, you should tell a coach you can challenge anything you want, but you get the same challenge system.
Yeah. I mean, look, because I know it was kind of a mess when they had it where you could challenge pass interference, but we still see some calls that one way or another, they're pretty egregious. And it's like, if you could just allow them to look at it, I think that'd be a good thing.
What bothers me is roughing the passers when a guy yep. hit a shoulder, not the head area, and they'll call him for a penalty. There should be a sky spy with big screens there with his finger on a button. If he sees something, it should be called or waved off. He immediately hits that button, tells the official, wave it off or call that. And people, oh, my God, if you do that, you're going to see holding in the secondary. No, that's not what you're looking at. You're looking for things around the ball, things that we see on TV every play better than they do any time.
John, appreciate the time as always. We'll talk next week.
Chase and Joe, thank you guys very much. You should get out that Beatles song and play it. Next week when I come on, I'd like for Nick to play All You Need Is Love.
All right.
Thank you.
We can do that. We can make that happen. Dr. Crane, you have your assignment.
I'm ready to go with that.
That's All You a good Need one. Is Love.
We'll come back with more here from Circus Sports in Kentucky here on 102.5 The Game.